Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
We are ready for the football show. Best way to start it, I guess, is with a view on Graeme Hunter coming on later in the show, is to talk to Gary Breen. Good evening, sir.
Good afternoon.
You are with us on our opening weekend of the Premier League campaign for the game at Arsenal. Man City winning 2-0. We're going to get into that as well. You're also with us this Sunday as Jose Mourinho takes his Manchester United side down to the coast to take on Brighton at the Amex Stadium. But look, we know you're an Arsenal fan, Gary. We spent a lot of last season discussing the end days and the end game in terms of Arsene Wenger with you. So that story has come and gone. And yet, there we were last Sunday. And for all intents and purposes, we may well have been watching an Arsene Wenger-managed Arsenal team. And the fallout in the last few days, for me, it's been a bit knee-jerk. It's been a bit too harsh on Unai Emery, who's trying to deal with changing a culture that's been insipid really there for a long, long time. What have you made of the last 3 or 4 days and the criticism that he already seems to be dealing with?
I think that's par for the course now for Premier League. I think supporters want everything on a quick fix, as if he was going to come in and suddenly they were going to be title challengers. We know it's a big job ahead. The only thing I would say in defence of them supporters is he's got to know his players better than he clearly did on Sunday. The very fact that they're asking the likes of Petr Cech, who's an iconic Premier League goalkeeper, to play out from the back, to two centre-halves in Sokratis and Mustafi, who are not ball-playing centre-backs, and they're looking to spread that defence and then rely on a young 19-year-old in Guendouzi to come in and play on the half-turn. Now, we saw the result. They try to match City or certainly play them at their own game. They're nowhere near that level. So he has to go back to the drawing board and say, listen, OK, maybe he wants to play that way, but it's going to take a bit of time. If someone like Petr Cech, with all his experience, all his quality, struggles as much as he did playing out from the back, then you have to address it. We know they've got a new goalkeeper in building. Whether he'll get the nod now, because Emery may well be adamant that that's how he wants to play. But I think in the Premier League, he's asking a lot of those players.
Yeah, it was an odd one that Cech did start the game, because it seems to be the perfect time of the season to drop your goalkeeper. You've got all summer to make the decision. You've spent a pretty sizable amount of money on Bernd Leno, and then you bring him in. And he has already said in the build-up to this Chelsea game, it's the game of the weekend, and it's another difficult assignment for Arsenal heading away from home in their second game under Emery, that it's going to be Petr Cech that's starting. I don't quite get this. I don't really understand it. Petr Cech, at times, really struggled last season, and really in the last couple of seasons under Arsene Wenger. Why bring Leno in and then have him sitting on the bench watching Petr Cech not play with a huge degree of confidence? I don't really understand it.
The only thing we can assume from that is, and I wouldn't be surprised, that Petr Cech has obviously gone away in the summer, come back for the new pre-season and performed well. You know, he's still a quality goalkeeper in terms of what he gives a team. I don't think he's at the level that we associate in terms of them title-winning Chelsea teams. The very fact that's why they let him go, to bring in the likes of Courtois. But you're right, I don't know whether or not they just wanted a bit more experience just to bed this in. But you're right, if you're going to make that decision to play out from the back, then Petr Cech's not your goalkeeper. It's as simple as that. But there's more problems in terms of and trying to play that style, is that if you're going to be expansive and make the pitch big, they haven't got enough athleticism in that central midfield area. Xhaka's not an athlete by any stretch of the imagination. We said about Guendouzi as a 19-year-old. Yes, he can run about, but he doesn't have the experience in terms of knowing where to be in certain scenarios. And if you've got two central midfielders like that, more often than not, you'll look to your right and left side of midfield and say, listen, tuck in and put a bit of a shift in. But invariably, that's Mkhitaryan, that's Ozil. That's not what they're all about. They want to go forward. And we saw how much Ozil and Mkhitaryan struggled with the athleticism, the pace and power that Manchester City had in their full-back areas. And listen, I'm not being remiss there. I know most players will, but I don't think their strength is staying with people running back. It's going forward. But there were so many other things that confused me, notably the fact that Ramsey played in that 10 role and Ozil played out on the right-hand side. And if you think about under Wenger, we've seen the likes of Ramsey, Wilshere, Theo Walcott, all so vocal that they wanted to play that luxury number 10 position. But the very fact was that Ozil was considerably better than all of them at it. And the main worry for me is that I understand that Ramsey wants to maybe model his game on a Frank Lampard in terms of getting into the box late. But Dave, you've seen, we both saw that too often he was at the focal point of the attack. He was, in fact, further forward than Aubameyang.
Yeah.
Because Aubameyang was trying to come into 10 and link. And if you're thinking about Arsenal and that midfield, they need that extra man in there. And if I was to address that, I think that Emery will probably say to Ramsey, listen, contribute in that midfield area, make your runs from there in support. He's got the energy to do that. And at times, it just looks so disjointed. But we shouldn't be surprised. We've seen the likes of Emery in terms of his successful teams with Valencia and Seville. We know he's a quality coach, but I don't think any one of us thought that he could change it overnight. And it's going to be a long process. Having said that, I still think that they've got the ammunition, certainly to hurt Chelsea, who are another club in transition. And Sarri said he's going to take 3 months to get his message across. But the very fact that he said, listen, he's going to build his team around David Luiz at centre-half in an orthodox four, that doesn't bode well for me. I think Arsenal can take advantage of it.
Yeah, we'll get on to Chelsea in a moment. A couple of other questions on Arsenal. Talk to me about Granit Xhaka. I've been trying to convince myself and maybe some of our my off-the-ball colleagues over the last year or so that potentially...
You've been trying to convince me.
And you. Potentially, he could be a really good Premier League midfielder because...
In what way, Dave? In what way? In terms of being on the ball, opening teams up,
I think
he's that type of midfielder.
I think he's athletic. I think he can pass. I think he has a tackle in him if he just thinks about it a bit more. I think if he spent a bit more time working on the defensive side of his game, he could offer himself as a bit more of a covering midfielder. I think he's tall, and I also think he's got a really good shot on him. Now, the problem is, all of the stuff I've just said, we haven't seen any of it, and his temperament is clearly not what it should be, because... For me, he's one of these players in the Arsenal squad. There's been several over the last years that doesn't deal in shame. And if I was he on the opening weekend of the Premier League season and there was a 19-year-old that had spent half his professional career of 26 matches playing in the French second division and had never played anywhere near this level, and when the game needed to be changed up by my new manager, Unai Emery, I was the guy he took off, the experienced World Cup level playing international midfielder and not the 19-year-old kid that had never seen a game of this magnitude, I'd be thoroughly ashamed of myself. And yet, I don't think he deals in that sort of an emotion, and he would have slept pretty easily on Sunday night.
So invariably, you just answered your own question there.
Yeah, well, I'm saying because I was trying to spend the last year convincing myself of these things, but it's not an argument that even myself can win at the moment.
Exactly, because you're talking about a guy who has been made one of the five captains appointed by Emery in terms of this leadership group. And I said it to you in commentary that the five people, Cech, Koscielny, Ramsey, Xhaka and Ozil, who all give him that title, are all the players that we've seen over the last two or three seasons where Arsenal have lacked leadership. The very fact that you have to name five leaders suggests you don't even have one.
Yeah.
Because you don't name five if you've got a proper leader in that squad. Now, I know Cech's a leader, of course he is, but he can't really influence it so much on the field. Around the training ground, yeah, of course he can. But the problem for me with Xhaka is that it's an unwillingness to do the dirty work, but worse than that is that he never learns from his mistakes. That Sterling goal, Sterling picks it up on the corner of the box on his left-hand side. He drives across the pitch. Now, as that happens, the right-back engages him first. As he goes across, the centre-half then comes out, blah, 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 like that. But certainly a midfielder should come out. Jonkon Drozi comes out, shepherds him them into Xhaka's area. And you're thinking, right, where's Xhaka now for the contact? Nowhere to be seen. We've seen it so often. We've seen the embarrassing ones like Watford away last season.
Yeah, Tom Cleverley's
goal.
I've
named so many. And this is the problem you have with him. It's all well and good saying that he has the potential. But this is a guy now, and you're talking about tackling. He's had two red cards, 24 yellows in his two seasons in the Premier League. That suggests he can't tackle. This is the issue you have. And
but
it's
he's
not
been playing...
me saying, and I'm not judging him by the huge standards that central midfielders have
asked. Neither am I. I'm judging him by pretty, you know, mundane central midfield standards that you would expect of a guy who has played that many times for Switzerland and has played in big leagues and big Champions League games. What I thought we might get from Emery was an immediate switch in the culture of that absence of accountability. And that when he arrives at the club, I know he's not signing players, but he's inherited this squad, that he takes someone like Xhaka, spends one-on-one time with him, shows him videos of where he believes Xhaka was good, and then shows him clips of where he feels he has to work in his game. And if he's showing him several clips of the same type of mistake, that he says to him, I believe you can be a really good midfielder for this team, but if this continues to happen, you will not play in my side. And,
well,
the key word you said, Dave,
is accountability. And I think there will be under Emery. I think there will be a lot of reviewing video analysis that I'm led to believe never happened under Wenger.
So if you're picking your 11,
you play off the cuff.
If you're picking your 11 for the Chelsea game, you take Xhaka out and you put Torreira in, and you say to Xhaka, until I see the sort of commitment and desire to improve and learn from my mistakes and leadership required from you, I'm actually going to go with the curly-haired 19-year-old alongside Torreira and not you.
Yeah, listen, I wouldn't disagree with that, and I don't think many Arsenal fans would. And it will be difficult then for Xhaka to win that argument because of the very fact that Emery can turn around and go, well, listen, I've worked on it. There's no doubt in my mind that Emery has watched so many games that Xhaka's had prior to being given the job and getting them back. He'd have worked out exactly where the weaknesses are. So I would be under no illusions that he said to Xhaka, listen, I can't have this. I can't have that lack of athleticism, that lack of protection in front of my back four. And I think even the centre-halves like Socrates will probably be saying, where were you? That's where you're supposed to be. And this is what we'll have. Now, if he doesn't play against Chelsea, because that was a huge surprise for us both that Torreira didn't start. I mean, this is a guy who was a real coup for Arsenal to get. We know that he's got so much ability. And to not start him in the first game of the season was a real surprise. I'm absolutely certain he'll start against Chelsea.
Yeah, I think he will. He did say he didn't think he was fit enough to start the game. But Uruguay went out in the second round. I don't really understand why Torreira wouldn't
have been
ready to go.
Well, he might be carrying injuries as opposed to fitness.
So, and it did look to me like they improved significantly, although not necessarily creating a whole pile of chances, when the three subs come in, Lichtsteiner, Torreira and Lacazette. So maybe two or all three of those will start at the weekend. They're up against a Chelsea team that really impressed me, Gary, against Huddersfield, because it could be a tricky enough spot to go to when in your first day of the season. We saw Huddersfield start pretty well last year, and then later in the season they gave City a run for the money and they beat Manchester United there. And, you know, bar one or two chances, it was a pretty easy routine victory for them. Jorginho settled in, he got his goal. Now, whether or not he stays in the penalties is another story. And all seemed to be rosy in the Sarri garden, bar Morata. And this guy looks like he's way off the pace again. What does Sarri do about Morata? Where are the goals going to come for Chelsea? Because they haven't made this signing that they need to make. They don't really have strength and depth in the attacking third of the field.
Well, if you're playing centre-forward for a Sarri team, you only have to listen to guys who have had it. Higuain, in terms of how many goals he got under him, that it's a dream. Everything's geared towards making sure that centre-forward gets a hatful of goals. So Morata must have initially looked and thought, this is a great opportunity for me, bearing in mind the defensive nature of Conte. But you're absolutely right. In terms of confidence, he looks shot. Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised to see Giroud come back into this team now in terms of giving them a focal point, because we've known and have always known throughout the Premier League success that Chelsea have had. Their quality is from their second line of attack, be it either Lampard, but now it's Hazard, Willian, those type of guys. So I think Hazard coming back will be a massive boost. You're always looking at potentially, is it Kovacic? Is that how you say it? From
Kovacic,
Real Madrid?
Yeah.
I'm not quite sure how you pronounce that. But he's a quality player, classy and elegant, a huge talent. But the difficulty with him coming from Real Madrid is in what position? We're talking about he's not defensive-minded enough to play holding, not productive enough as a 10 where assists and goals are what you're judged on. But it has been interesting that Jorginho comes in and releases Kante a little bit to go forward. Because in the modern day now, you don't really see box-to-box midfielders anymore because the game's so quick. But if there's anyone who can do it, it's N'Golo Kante. He gets his goal, scruffy as it was, but nevertheless, he's in there. And you have to think that Barkley probably looks a little bit vulnerable now in terms of coming out of the team, because he is a young star who hasn't really kicked on. It was a real surprise in terms of the move to Chelsea, and certainly for the amount that he went for. But I think Sarri has been quite vocal in saying it's going to take him 3 months to get his message across to these players. And I think it will. I think the way that he plays and the way that his Napoli team was so expansive and exciting to watch was certainly something Chelsea fans will look forward to. But like I said with Arsenal, that won't happen overnight. And you have to worry about David Luiz, Alonso and an orthodox back four. They're brilliant stepping into midfield, making passes. But being turned is not their strength. And you certainly think that Aubameyang can hurt them.
Yeah, you really would. That if there's somewhere that Arsenal could exploit Chelsea, it might be in those types of areas. Like they do have Christensen, if they want to bring him back into the team. At times he looked pretty comfortable in that position last season as a centre-half. What's the best way to get at David Luiz? Explain to us as a centre-half why you have so many doubts about him in a flat back four in comparison to when he's in the middle or on the wider part of a three.
I think at David Luiz, and I think he's a gifted footballer, I genuinely believe that. He's an athlete, he's strong, he's quick, he can deal with certain situations in the air. But if you're talking about his mindset, he does not think in an orthodox back four. He doesn't see danger quick enough, and that's why in a three, in the middle of a three, he's protected a little bit. He'll have Azpi Colaqueta on the right-hand side, just narrowing up. He'll have Cahill on the left-hand side, who doesn't want to be out wide, so will narrow up again. So ultimately, then, with N'Golo Kanté in front of him, there's very little space for him to be exploited when he makes those poor decisions, those split decisions. And that's the difference. Now, in an orthodox back four, Alonso, who is the same, doesn't think defensively quick enough. We saw that against Manchester City, where he was caught out. And the very fact now that he's a left back as opposed to a wing back, he has to get back narrow quicker than he does. And because he doesn't, it just leaves so much space in around the, David Luiz, and that's where you will exploit him. I've seen him so often in a back four. I think at times he looks majestic the way he steps in, makes passes, so much so that at times Chelsea have tried to play him as that holding midfielder. But if you're thinking about decision-making in and around the box where that split second where if you don't see it quick enough, you don't adjust quick enough, and notably you don't get into a good position early enough, you'll be punished at this level. And I think he will be.
OK, finally, we did discuss Pogba and the whole Marino situation in detail with John Giles earlier in the show, but that is our live game on Sunday. We've just the one live game because of the All-Ireland Hurling Final. Yourself and myself will be at the Amex Stadium as United make that pretty long trip down to the south coast to take on Brighton. The manner in which they beat Leicester was hardly impressive, Gary, but they're up against a Brighton side that were dreadful, really, against Watford. And you think it's a handy enough game to have as your first away game. What are you expecting from Manchester United on Sunday? More of the same, that a probable victory, but certainly not something that will be achieved in style?
Well, I don't think it'll be expansive, an attack philosophy that so many Manchester United fans crave under Mourinho, but it will be functional. I think they'll win. You're quite right to say that Brighton, despite quite a lot of investment over the summer, and only one of their new signings played against Watford, but they were woeful. Chris himself said it. He said, listen, no excuses for the performance. We didn't deserve anything today. They were second best all over. That's coming from Chris Hughton, who's normally so protective of these players. So it's a real challenge now for these Brighton players. No better opportunity than Manchester United, coming to town, the biggest show in town at the time. But I think United, we keep hearing these stories coming out where Pogba's flexing his muscles. Make no mistake about that. He's talking to the press now in a way that he didn't before. He's letting it be known that he's not particularly happy, because he knows he has the backing of Ed Woodward in terms of his commercial value to that club. Mourinho has to try and work it now. He's given him the captaincy to try and cajole him, to try and get him back on side. And I've no doubt that Pogba is a quality player, but we're talking about a functional player, a central midfield player, when you think about Mourinho's top Chelsea teams, that everyone just stuck to their little bit of job and didn't go off trying to do other things. Pogba, in his defence, is a young player, He's a player who's wanting to prove he's one of the best in the world. So it's difficult for him because he's probably thinking, I just don't want to sit in front of the back four and play side-to-side passes and protect these centre-halves. I want to show you how good I am. And that's the difficulty that Mourinho has. I think, as you quite rightly said, Pereira's come in, given a bit of a base, Fred as well. Although Fred's not this holding midfielder everyone claims to be. He's got more than that. But in a three, it looks like it suits Pogba much better. We've said this. It's been well publicised at this stage that he's better in a three. That's how good he was for Juventus. But it was a difficult one. It'd be fascinating to see how this develops, because it just doesn't seem that that whole club is in sync with one another in the way that Manchester City are, the way that Liverpool are. And I mean from owners to managers to players to supporters. Those two, their biggest rivals, are all going in the wrong direction altogether. Manchester United don't seem to have that type of togetherness, and they're struggling because of it.
Do you buy into the theory that the posturing from Mourinho on the pre-season, the comments about how their pre-season fixtures weren't what he wanted, that he wasn't been given the chance to go out and buy the players that he wanted, he was been stymied by the board, that he was essentially just a head coach and no longer, a football manager, that he was engineering his exit? Or is that really a nonsensical way looking at it, that no manager really in the right mind would be doing that and he was just speaking his mind?
Well, I think ultimately, that speaking his mind, I think he probably thinks, listen, I'm going to make sure that everyone knows why I'm not bridging the gap to Manchester City, which is a huge talent challenge anyway because of how good Pep's team are. But he's met this type of challenge head on before.
He was given over 300 million, though, to bridge the gap, Gary.
World-class players, yeah.
Like, he spent a pile of money. It's not like he hasn't been given the opportunity.
And this is where, on the whole argument with Manchester United, I genuinely think, Dave, as you said to me, right, argue Pogba's case, I think I could. If you said to me, argue Mourinho's case, I think I could do a good job of it. And if you said to me, argue the hierarchy's case at Manchester United in terms of Ed Woodward, I think I could do that as well.
Yeah.
Because the reality is, Ed Woodward could probably turn around to Mourinho now and say, well, hold on a minute. You're talking about wanting centre-halves. We've given you two centre-halves in the last two summer windows, Eric Bailly, Lindelof. Why are they now not good enough? But the very fact is, Mourinho will turn around and say, well, listen, I thought they potentially could be. The reality is, they're not. Not good enough for us to challenge at the top of the Premier League. So if you think about Mourinho's argument then, I don't understand why you'd employ Jose Mourinho, who is about the present. He's not about the future. He's never done that throughout his career. You buy him and bring him into Manchester United to cope and challenge Guardiola. That's why he's brought in. So if you do bring him in, give him exactly what he wants. If not, what's the point? If you're talking about developing people and young players coming through, then Pochettino's your man. And then I'd argue then that Mourinho's saying, listen, the way football's gone now, it's about head coaches and not managers. Well, possibly. But the reality and the fact of the matter is that Pochettino's title has now changed from head coach to manager. And that's a result of the trust that the owner and Daniel Levy have in him to give him carte blanche to say, right, whatever you want, we'll do. Okay. And that's not what they're doing at Manchester United. They don't trust Mourinho. He doesn't trust them. Pogba doesn't trust Mourinho. He doesn't trust Pogba. It's a mess.
It is a mess. We'll see how messy exactly it is Sunday afternoon. Gary, we'll chat to you then. Thanks a million.
Pleasure.
Gary Breen giving his thoughts ahead of the Premier League weekend. The two biggest games, probably that one between Arsenal and Chelsea at Stamford Bridge, and then our live game Sunday afternoon, a 4 o'clock kickoff at the Amex Stadium, Brighton hosting Manchester United.
Football on Off The Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.
Yes, welcome back. It is my delight to be able to say Graeme Hunter is on the line. Good evening, sir.
Your delight is smaller than mine. I know it's not about size, but your delight is smaller than mine.
Listen, I was commentating on the UEFA Super Cup final last night. So for that reason, it is a Super Cup final that I have paid more attention to than any previous staging of that game. Are they always that feisty? Are they always taken that seriously?
Yeah, when two Spanish clubs are involved, they've almost permanently, if you think about Georgia, Sevilla against Barca, I think it ended 5-4 extra time. If you think about the, granted, this is the first time two teams from the same city have played, but every time that there's, you know, what about the game in Monte Carlo between Atleti and Chelsea, Real Madrid and Manchester United, certainly the Spanish teams, you know, joking aside, because I know that you're telling the listeners too, Off The Ball, who didn't watch it, that this was an epic match. It felt like a mid-March game, something with everything hanging on it, not just a nominally smaller cup. The Spanish teams take this very seriously. They believe that it's part of your bragging rights. It's a European trophy. And given that I'm currently in my holiday resort wearing Aberdeen shorts and they've got two European stars on it, I think the case for the importance of the Super Cup doesn't need to be made any more strongly than that. It's a European trophy, man.
Yeah, and you could tell there were tears streaming down the face from people on both sides of the Madrid divide over the course of the game. Atletico Madrid fans are clearly overjoyed by it. And when we were covering the game, Graeme, there was a feeling for us that because they had never got the better of Real Madrid in a one-off game or over two legs in the what was now 10 times they faced each other, it meant more to Atleti. But you could see Lopetegui was not happy, that he felt, right, this is an early blow to my reign. I don't have that much wriggle room. There's no credibility in the bank like Zidane brought with everything that he had done for the club. And I left the game thinking that he's already on the back foot. It is just the Super Cup final in UEFA terms, but is that a stretch?
Well, no, look, realism and the amount of time you've spent studying or broadcasting on the professional game means that, you know, your sixth sense is fair. But let's join together and cry out for a little bit of common sense as well. So, for example, there's a great deal of coverage in the Madrid press today, and there was last night in the radio and television about, I mean, the television coverage, the host broadcaster in Spain immediately asked Butragueño, does this mean you've got to go out and sign now? There are people already sort of saying, well, Lopetegui's on the back foot. Okay, fine. For those who weren't paying full attention or those who didn't watch, let's bear in mind that once Diego Costa puts Atleti 1-0 up, Madrid absolutely dominate the final. And what's more, for 43 minutes of the first half and for a good 15, 20 minutes of the second half, actually play outstanding football. If you could bottle and roll out over the remainder of the domestic season at least, the passing, the movement, the commitment, the attention, the creativity, the cutting edge that Madrid showed in going from 1-0 down to 2-1 up, then they'll win the title. The sad thing is that two influences crashed into each other. One, at a point when Atleti were attacking for the first time in some 20 minutes, Marcelo kept a ball in the far left-hand touchline, Kehler's far left-hand touchline, for no good reason. Not only kept it in, but flipped it back over his own head such that Atleti had the perfect setup for Correa, a sub, so an impact man, to beat a player and get to the byline. And even though he knocks it with his bad foot out of his own reach, somehow gets there quickly with his right foot, hooks it back past Kehler, and it's stabbed in by Costa. That was impact number one. And impact number two was Atleti, because more of their players have been back longer, because they've got this famous Professor Ortega, their fitness guy. More of their players were fit for the remainder of normal time and extra time, and Madrid fell away. But that won't happen throughout the season, and I have to emphasise, Atleti won it. It's historic. It, you know, when Simeone came and they hadn't beaten Real Madrid since 1999, he beat them in the league. He beat them in the cup final. He beat them in the Spanish Super Cup. The only thing that was missing was knocking them out of Europe or beating them in Europe. He's added that. It's dangerous for Lopetegui, and it adds to all our idea that the continuity of Griezmann staying and of Godin staying and of Oblak choosing to stay and the additions of Lemar and Kalinic, and there's quality additions in every department. All of that says this is a big impact to Real Madrid, and maybe they now go and do one more big piece of business before the market closes. But I saw the European champions under Lopetegui playing outstandingly for two-thirds of that match.
Yeah, I think the fact is, if that ball is just hooked over the roof of the stand, that small stand in that stadium in Tallinn, well then, by Marcelo, the game is over and Lopetegui gets the best possible start, winning a derby and adding a trophy in his first week in charge, which, as you say, would have been the perfect start. So, I mean, history is written by the success of those who win these big games. So, let's just look maybe what happened in extra time. And ultimately, you're looking at a team that finished 17 points behind Barcelona. They also finished behind Atletico Madrid last year. And there were times in their run to the Champions League title where they really could have gone out. They did ride their luck at times en route, most notably in the final, where they were gifted two goals by the Liverpool goalkeeper. So they've added nobody bar a goalkeeper, when it's not exactly like Keylor Navas was letting them down over the last 4 years, was it, when he picked up all these medals. So if they don't buy, is it possible to see them going as far as they were with all these players 1 year older and doubts over a couple of the top guys as to whether or not they can fill the shoes of Ronaldo? Is it plausible to envisage Real Madrid winning La Liga and or the Champions League without signing anybody before this continental transfer window shuts?
I'll go further and throw this back at me, please, in May or June or maybe April. But, you know, I'll go further and say the absence of Cristiano Ronaldo already tells me that they will not win the Champions League for two reasons. One, players, no matter how good they are, how thorough they are, or how big the trophy is, when they win something repeatedly, a tiny little switch goes off in the psyche. And therefore, you know, over these four Champions Leagues won since 2014, there's no doubt that the key figure is Cristiano Ronaldo. The fact that he's gone, And you can't naturally replace him. You might evolve solutions, but you can't go out and buy a replacement. They won't win the Champions League. I'm absolutely sure of that. Domestically, there doesn't need to be a collapse. I think the team spirit will evolve. And I think we saw in Lopetegui's tactics, played out brilliantly for 70 minutes, exactly some of the remedies that your discourse about the occasionally playground football solutions that Zidane found in the Champions League, where you're like, they're out. No, they're not. Look, they're at the other end. Oh, look, they've chucked one in, or the keeper's thrown one in against them, or whatever it might be, both for Bayern and for Liverpool. You know, I understood what you were not parodying or criticising, but pointing out that they were fallible even though they won. I think there'll be a better team spirit now. I honestly believe that strongly, that they have the right people to step forward and to reassert personality, to reassert claims for greatness. And domestically, I think they can genuinely be competitive. I thoroughly believe that. If they go and add, they're not going to get Salah now. They're probably not going to get Hazard now. Do they get Rodrigo from Valencia for an exorbitant price? Possibly. Might that be the very business that Lopetegui, who remember, introduced Rodrigo to the Spanish team? Might that be what Lopetegui says if they ask him? Yeah, it definitely could be. Might they win the title? Yeah, I think they're going to be better than last season domestically. But, you know, it was a big day yesterday. While this was happening, and while it became clear that Real Madrid's principal task is to win the title in Spain for what would only be the fifth time in 16 years, Leo Messi, elsewhere in the Camp Nou, in the pre-season friendly against Boca Juniors, as the new captain, it's the presentation match, gets the microphone on the pitch beforehand, as captains do, praises Xavi, praises Iniesta, say, the people I'm inheriting from have been great. But he says a phrase about, we had a great season last season, the league, the cup, but there's a thorn in our side. And the only way we can remove it is by bringing that beautiful, desired Champions League trophy back to this stadium. And we're going to give our utmost to do that. Now, it's a nice, rabble-rousing captain's speech. You'd be surprised if he said, well, we'll do our best to compete and the Europa League is fine. What he was saying was priority. And therefore, I think you've got an ultra-interesting situation in that Barca's priority is the Champions League. Real Madrid's priority is the league. And I think both Atleti, and we haven't mentioned them so far, Valencia, have outside chances of winning the title. I think we have a four-way title chase until at least March, which we haven't had for the longest time. And I think we've got Barcelona suddenly a slightly more enticing prospect in Europe because they actively want to rid the smear of the memory of Paris away, Juventus away, Roma away. It's all there for us.
That is a pretty picture you paint. It would be brilliant if we could get to that point. Of course, over here, we're in a situation where none of us can actually watch La Liga unless we sign up to 11 Sports, but that's for a different night entirely, that part of the discussion. One more question specifically on Real.
50 quid, listen, I don't work for them, but 50 quid?
Yeah.
To see that quality of match, something like maybe 40 times over the season if you take all the matches in? Spend your money.
You make a valid point. We'll see if we can come up with the goods. One more question on Real before we get a more of a general sense of Barca, Valencia and Atletico. There's always an air of vulnerability around any Real Madrid manager because it just doesn't take long for things to unravel ever so slightly and before you know it, you're one result away from the chopping block. But what is your sense of where Lopetegui stands with the key men, the stakeholders within that Real dressing room? And the manner in which he left the Spanish job, would someone like Sergio Ramos feel that he was incredibly harshly done by and he's going to show the world that Lopetegui could have done very well for Spain in the World Cup and we'll get him off to the best possible start? Or is there a sense that I'm looking at their fixture list, in the space of five games from mid-September onwards, they have to visit Sevilla, they have to host Atleti at the Bernabeu and they have to go to Barca 2 weeks later, that he could find himself in a really awkward spot very early in the season. Will the backing be there from up top and from within that changing room?
Look, you've layered complex questions together there, and I'll say that Sergio Ramos doesn't quite function that way. He won't go out and do it for the boss. But in Ramos, Lopetegui has a firm ally. Up above him, in general, if you want to say, we'll take the time machine and we'll cast 10 weeks forward and things haven't gone well. Does Lopetegui have huge balustrades in the executive department, in the media, in his reputation that can prop him up if he's under fire? No. No. He's not as vulnerable as Rafa Benitez was, but he's completely unlike Mourinho, Ancelotti, Zidane. In recent times, and therefore he has only results. That's everything. One of the key things that will help paint the picture you're asking for is that several of the young players owe their development to him. Several of them won junior international trophies before they were first team regulars anywhere. They got that experience with young Spain, whether it be 19s or 21s, of working together, going abroad, lifting a trophy, understanding tough times, coming through, taking responsibility. With his relationship concerning Carvajal, with his relationship concerning Isco, Rodrigo, these are very positive things. And I'll tell you something else. He's a coach that people like working for. The daily regime is going to be good. It's going to be demanding. He's nobody's fool. But he's also asking them to... This is where he links to Zidane, one of the few ways. He asks them to play a brand of football that they like, both with and without the ball. Now, you know, and the listeners know, if you're selling that ticket to your players, whether you're Stoke City or Dundalk or Real Madrid, you've immediately got an adherence to standards and to energy and to will. And Lopetegui's got that. So is he immune from, I think you're hinting at, is he immune from the disease of not making it to the end of the season? No, he's not. Will the Spain debacle count against him within Real Madrid or within the Real Madrid supporting media? No, it won't. That blame will go to Rubiales, the president of the Spanish FA. So we've got a situation where Lopetegui's fate is slightly more in his own hands than people imagine, because the players are with him. He is an adept coach. He's got these younger players at a time when they, like Asensio, didn't start the Champions League final, scored in one, but feels he's got to prove himself. Lucas, having scored a penalty in Milan to win against Atleti the second time around, didn't make the squad in Cardiff. You've got players who've got multiple winners' medals who want to have their own winners' medals, if you get me.
I do.
And I think that's positive. So Real Madrid are a ship which could ship take in water quickly, but are much more robust and much better equipped for stormy seas than people imagine.
Okay, that's an interesting one. That it is just going to be down to results, and maybe stuff that's gone before isn't necessarily going to have an impact on them. Looking at Atletico last night, and there was a sense maybe towards the end of last season that at some stage Diego Simeone was actually going to be prized away, and there was a lot of talk linking him to the job at the Emirates Stadium and various other jobs over the course of maybe through Italy and France as well. Last night he looked like he was ready to rock, Graham, that he was taking this to heart as much as he had any game since he took charge in 2011. And you mentioned the importance of the likes of Godin and Griezmann opting to stay, Oblak opting to stay. Lamar looked brilliant last night. I thought Saul in that central area was excellent. I think Diego Simeone is almost like being given a restart, a reboot, and he's ready to go all over again.
Look, I think you need to take into account several things. Number one, if he could learn English, he'd be the Chelsea manager, not only now, but some considerable time ago. He's been offered the Chelsea job at least three times via his sister, who represents him. He's taken English lessons, and while his sidekick, German Mono Burgos, has very good English, Cholo just can't do it. And he understands that he's a mega Gary Neville. When Gary Neville came into Valencia, I certainly believed, and Gary Neville believed, that his force of personality and his speed of learning a new language could allow him to transmit the good things that he has in his brain. When he was sacked, he said, I saw that via translator, I wasn't getting across enough of what I wanted. I made a mistake. Simeone's wise enough to know that going to England and trying to filter his determination, but also his people skills or his intensity through a translator isn't going to work. Hence, once you close something off to yourself in your mind and you're not sitting wistfully saying, what if or I wish, you do get a new burst of energy. Next, the Wanda Metropolitano has proven itself to be a home, not something new or jinxed or an albatross around the next big and empty. They've won the Europa League, yet another big trophy to turn the disappointment of the Champions League performance into marching their way to Lyon and beating Marseille, beating Arsenal. That renews your energy. To hear the people that you've put faith in, Oblak, Griezmann,
Godin,
saying, no way am I going. And then it coming to the very end of the market and Godin saying, I'm not going to quadruple my wages and take one last shot at glory at Manchester United. I'm staying too. Fabulous. He's been given the Colombian right back he wanted. He's been given Lamar for a record sum. If this didn't re-energize you, then absolutely nothing would. And do we believe in life in pots of goals at the end of the rainbow? Well, where's the Champions League final next June?
Yeah.
Metropolitano.
It's at the Wanda, I know. It's an enormous carrot, isn't it?
That would buzz you up, right?
Absolutely. It's no surprise when you put it that way. It is an interesting watch seeing him, as we saw at the Emirates Stadium as well, enclosed in what seems like a tiny box. It is a corporate suite. And you know, it's all relative, but and he's pacing left and right and back again. I'd love to get a pedometer on him and see exactly how many miles he's clocked up over the course of the game in that little box of his. Question of Barcelona, you've already mentioned them in passing. They obviously start the season as favourites, Graham. They've made a couple of interesting additions. It's going to be very entertaining to see where Lionel Messi is, and is he going to be, as we expect him to be, at his absolute best? Will the signings bed in quickly? Will, as you said, maybe their slightly greater focus on the Champions League take away from their La Liga performances? Where are you expecting Barcelona to be in comparison to when they were at their best last season?
Similar. They've added youth. They've added pace. They've added competition for places in some of the right areas. I believe that Artur, the Brazilian, is somebody who, albeit not brought up in the Barca philosophy, shows a thinking about the game, which is very much like the Barcelona philosophy. That's encouraging, and he'll only develop. I think that although Malcolm's arrival was not a specific petition of Valverde, more an opportunity cost from the board saying he's available, Roma about to get him, let's dive in, hurt Roma, take him, develop him, and he scored last night against Boca Juniors. A very, very good goal. He has pace. He doesn't waste the ball. He doesn't give the ball away much. Very left-footed, but you could see him fitting in there. He's acted, instead of Dembele sulking, he's acted as a stimulus to Dembele. Privately, they said to the club, what the hell are you thinking about? That's my place he's taking. Why are you signing him? What Dembele did publicly was cut short his holidays, come back, demand to be picked for the Super Cup, start the game and score the winning goal with the best goal of his Barcelona career so far. You've got a Coutinho who spent January to May getting better every single week, assuming more responsibility, not for Iniesta's role, but for being the guy who says to the rest of the team, if Messi is absent, rested, suspended, or not playing well, I'll step into his gap. He's not of the same level, but they cannot fold when Messi's not on form or not there. Coutinho is a small part of that remedy. There is enough to say. Munir returning ahead of Alcacer is a boost. There's enough to say that Barcelona can be not only competitive, but entertaining. Worth your time watching in Europe and domestically. And I think that there is added steel and rigour. And if, like with Paulinho, Arturo Vidal can shock people and show an understanding of Leo Messi's demands, and show a hunger and a work rate, then Arturo Vidal is the kind of big, bald samurai that they were missing in the 4-0 in Paris and the 3-0 in Turin.
He brings the edge, doesn't he?
The 3-0 in Rome. I'd say he does. Look, if you came out of a pub with one too many down you and you saw him in a dark alley on a Friday night, you'd salute and walk the other way, right?
Don't go near him. Avoid that man as much as you possibly can. I love why he's not necessarily cut from the Barcelona stone, from the Barcelona club, but you do think he's just going to bring that little bit of an edge that, as you say, maybe they were lacking in times of those really big games. As brief as you can, Graham, I know that's not necessarily your forte. Valencia, you've already mentioned them. They are your dark horses. They take on Atletico in what is clearly the game of opening weekend. Set the scene for us on that one.
It's interesting because Marcelino is a demanding coach who pushes his players and in the past has had a reputation of tiring his players out. Everybody who stayed is 1 year on and understands his standards. Those who've come that are new, in general, are fabulous signings. They've wanted Kevin Gamero for about 18 months. They've got him. Batshuayi will be the new Zaza will go. But when you've got Batshuayi, Gamero, Santi Mina and potentially Rodrigo if he stays up front. You add Cheryshev, who we know is both quick and creative and has goals in him and had a terrific World Cup. You may get Geddes back. You've kept Fran Torres and Carlos Soler, the brilliant youth products from your own stable. You've added a colossal, absolutely colossal defender from Lyon. The inheritor to Samuel Umtiti at Lyon has already been bought up and brought to Valencia. When you keep Kondogbia and turn him from a loan signing into a permanent signing, you add Puccini. I went to the Valencia match at Leicester pre-season and Puccini stood out. You keep the captain, Dani Parejo, who is the best Spanish player not to have gone to the World Cup and probably should have been there. You're looking at goals, better organisation, competitiveness, pace, intelligence, a depth of squad and a side, a club which knows what winning a title is about. It's been a while, but it's not virgin territory. Are they going to win the title? You'd say not, but there was no chance last season and there is a small chance this season and they will take big scalps. That's your big deal. More often when you tune in to watch or when you go on Ryanair weekends to La Liga's grounds, more often you will see Betis, Sevilla, Villarreal, Valencia and Atleti toppling the big two.
Yeah, it's. I'm looking at their fixture list. Once they get Atleti out of the way, they have a run of pretty winnable games, six of them before they have to take on Barca on the 7th of October. So there's no reason why they can't build some early season belief. I told you the delight would be all mine, Graeme. Brilliant to talk to you. We'll chat to you next week.
Talk to you soon.
Football on Off the Ball.
Brought to you by the Boyle Sports app. Cash out and in-play betting available in the App Store and Google Play Store.